next speaker is Jane Ridley, the Professor of Modern History at Buckingham University. She's the distinguished biographer of Disraeli, Edward VII, and Queen Victoria, and she won the Duff Cooper Prize in 2002 for The Architect and His Wife, a biography of her great-grandfather, the great architect Edward Butkins. And her latest book, widely reviewed to huge praise, is George V, Never a Dull Moment. Jane Ridley.
Harry, thank you so much for such a generous introduction. And goodness, you do have a good lunch, don't you? A wonderful lunch and a wonderful place to be. I'm going to talk terribly briefly. We've all got a 10-minute rule hanging over our heads. I'm going to talk very briefly about my recent book, about George V, and about writing about George V. Now, George V is not perhaps a name that leaps to the public imagination. I think I found when I was writing the book that the most common reaction was people to come up to me with a pitying look and say, how are you going to deal with the dullness? And so one of my chief preoccupations throughout writing the book was, how was he really dull? Or was he just ordinary? Or was he using ordinariness or dullness as a sort of a form of political manipulation? A sort of, you know, was it political or was it him? Researching a book for a king like him is actually quite a lot of work. I was incredibly lucky to get access to the George V papers in the Royal Archives in the Round Tower of Windsor Castle. And so you trench down from Oxford, sorry, from London, by various trains. If you don't miss the trains, you arrive there, if you're me, about 10:30. And then you have to walk up 89 steps, stone steps inside the tower. I don't know what happens if you can't walk. But anyway, you can't really have a wheelchair up those steps, I don't think. And you spend the day transcribing all these fascinating documents. And it is a complete treat to work in this wonderful place, and I feel very privileged to have done that. But the trouble about some of these documents is that they do give credence to this idea of George V as being a rather dull character. The one that really perhaps condemns him as a dull man, is his diary, which he wrote. Every day of his life, I think, he would settle down while Queen Mary next door was being read to by her lady-in-waiting. The king would settle down at his desk and write a paragraph about the day. And so he would describe it, you know, the weather, fair, cloudy, breakfast, when he got up, who he saw, what exercise he did, I mean, whether he walked or rode after breakfast, then bed, usually 11:10. So the biographer has to read through this, really important. And what you realise, actually, reading through it, is that although it is pretty dull, it is, for a biographer, complete gold dust, because it gives you absolutely everything that he did, everybody who he saw, every conversation that he had, is locked in those diaries. But that's just the beginning of writing about King George V. And as I'm suggesting, the diaries may seem dull, but actually they're really important. They're not really dull. And also, I think the other thing is that George V reigned at a time, 1910 to 1936, for those of you who like dates, which was a period of extreme political turbulence, crisis, you know, constitutional crisis, trade union crisis, First World War, threat of Bolshevism, general strike, great crash. I mean, it really couldn't be a more difficult period in which to steer a ship of state. And George V does this brilliantly. He emerged to me as an amazingly effective politician in a period rather like our own, when politicians were not up to much. Perhaps, you know, we need to get the king back. And at the same time, George V could be extremely funny. He liked to sort of show off about being a Philistine. And it is true, he didn't have much taste in art or interest in art. But he did know what he didn't like. So, for example, when he was walking past in the National Gallery, walking past a Cézanne, he turned to Queen Mary, his wife. He said, "May, here's," he called her May, that's her sort of nickname, pet name. He said, "May, here's something to make you laugh," and he sort of shook his stick at it and walked on. This was Cézanne. also, you know, he pretended, I think, that he knew less than he did, but once the Prime Minister wrote to the King saying, "I think you should send Thomas Hardy, the famous novelist and poet, you should send him a telegram because it's his 70th birthday." The King looked a bit mystified by this, but he duly obliged, sent Hardy the telegram. What, of course, the King didn't realise was that the Prime Minister was talking about the novelist. The King was talking about the man in Alnwick who made his fishing rods. And he couldn't think why the King thought he'd got so old suddenly. So I think that, in a sense, George V is sort of, you know, playing on this idea of ordinariness to project an image of himself. But it is true that before he became King, he really didn't do an awful lot. One of his first biographers, the excellent Harold Nicholson, wrote that for 17 years, George did nothing but kill animals and stick in stamps. And this is absolutely true. But what Nicholson doesn't say is that George V was extremely good at all these things. He was one of the top five shots in Britain during his lifetime. Now, that is really difficult. If you're being Prince of Wales as well as a top shot, you have to stay all over the country. He would shoot during the shooting season about 100 days a year, which is, it's like having a job. he would stand there, 28 shots running, he would kill a bird. There would be sort of three men acting as loaders to him. And he was jolly effective. The only side effect he felt was slightly shaky hands afterwards. So I think we should be rather proud of our shooting king. The other thing is George's stamp collection. Well, again, it's easy to mock. But George's stamp collection actually was extremely distinguished. He had enough money to buy intact collections belonging to old collectors. And he actually managed, during his lifetime, to build up I think the most distinguished stamp collection in this country, probably. We just can only slightly regret that he chose to collect stamps rather than, paintings. But never mind. It shows, I think, that he had the brain, the capacity to act as a proper collector of interesting things instead of stamps, but never mind. So I just think that we need to look again at George V, and we need also to appreciate the significance of his wife, Queen Mary. Now, Queen Mary is often written off as being a sort of grand dame, and there are lots and lots of rather unkind, funny stories about her, which I slightly guess are made by men, but I may be wrong. There's a sort of sexist critique of Queen Mary. But Queen Mary and George actually had a really strong marriage. I've been lucky enough to see the letters that they wrote between each other. They're not sort of gushing, and he always actually has to write to her if he's got something to tell her important, because he can't actually say it. So his letters are often the key to their marriage in that respect. But what does emerge from the letters is just how much George depended on Queen Mary's judgment. And the fact that she was female did not deter him from asking her advice on almost every important decision. So I think that this partnership is actually rather important, as we can perhaps see today. Partnership between king and queen is a strong marriage, makes a much better monarch. The monarch is always fighting with their spouse. It's going to be much harder for them to devote enough time to being king or queen. One of the things I did feel after writing the book was that Queen Mary is really a much more fascinating figure than I thought, who deserves much more recognition and deserves perhaps to be written about quite seriously. So, finally, I think that George was very much in his politics committed to the preservation, the maintenance of the dynasty. And so it was him who, in 1917, changed his surname. He had a German name. He didn't actually know what his surname was. He thought it was Wettin, but there may have been something else. He was perfectly agreeable to having his name changed and to losing Saxe Coburg Gotha and instead becoming, of course, Windsor, which was a brilliant sort of guess just made by his secretary, which worked perfectly as a title for the new king. The slight problem was that there were already some people called Windsor Clive, but George said it would be an honour for them to be called that he was called Windsor. So I think that you get, despite all the sort of jokes and things, you do get with George V something that is essential to any good king, which is a commitment to maintaining the dynasty. He will do whatever it takes. He will change his name, but he will also do the thing for which he is perhaps best known and most reviled today, which is to refuse asylum to his first cousin, Tsar Nicholas II in Russia. He will do that because he believes, rightly or wrongly, and I think perhaps in retrospect wrongly, but it was a genuine belief, that he needed, that if he brought the king to, sorry, the Tsar, to Britain, this could have a very disruptive effect and particularly encourage the Labour Party to take up Bolshevism. So it's on those sort of grounds, the stability, the survival of the dynasty, that led him to make that decision. And of course, he also reinvented the monarchy to be a sort of family monarchy, a family on the throne. And that is always something that can be rather dangerous. In George's case, it certainly was, because he quarrelled with his elder son, Edward David, whatever you like to call him, Duke of Windsor. And that quarrel was one of the key causes of the abdication. So, on the whole, I would say George V is a far more interesting character than you might have thought. If he is dull, it's completely fascinating. And I would also say that it would be lovely if you were able to find out even more about George V by buying the book. Thank you very much.